Our speaker today is Susan Moon, who is a writer, editor, and lay teacher in the Soto Zen tradition. Susan received entrustment as a lay teacher in 2005, and she leads a variety of workshops throughout the country, including at Spirit Rock and Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. For many years, she was the editor of The Turning Wheel, which is a journal of socially engaged Buddhism. And she's authored a number of books about Buddhism, including a book which I find extremely touching and humorous. It's called This Is Getting Old, Zen Thoughts on Aging with Humor and Dignity. And it's she has it for sale over here, so and it's a joy. The last time she was here, she talked about her book, The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. And now she has another book, and I was hoping she'd have it here today, but it's not quite out yet. I guess it's starting to appear in bookstores. And it's called What is Zen? Plain Talk for a Beginner's Mind, which she co-authored with Norman Fisher. So following her presentation, as usual, we'll have some of her books for sale over in the corner. And the title of her talk this morning is What Does Death Have to Teach the Living? So let's give a warm welcome to author Susan Moon.
Thank you, Barbara, and thank you all for coming. It's great to be back here. I really enjoy this community and this church. As a Buddhist, I feel a lot of resonance with UU Fellowship, and I know there's a lot of overlap, and you can be both a Buddhist and a UU person. So some of my friends are. Anyway, it's a great community you have here, and it's an honor to be able to share some thoughts with you this morning. And so yes, I am going to talk about death. Not in the way, I mean, a lot of people are writing and talking about death now more and more, which is great. And there's a lot being written about being with dying people, hospice work, about the medicalization of death and issues around that. And those are wonderful things to explore. I'm going to be talking more about, as Barbara said, the title I chose is What Does Death Mean to the Living? How does the fact of our mortality affect our lives as we live them? And what does it mean to us that we are going to die? And I've really been immersing myself in this question and thinking about it a lot. And it's becoming more and more of an urgent topic the older I get. I am reminded of it more often because my friends and relatives are dying more frequently as my cohort gets older. So I can't forget about it, really. And I'm interested in it. I'm really interested in trying to understand what is death anyway. I think that's part of what motivates my interest in Buddhism, and the reason I took up the study of Zen in the first place was to try and understand, you know, what is death? What is life and death? What is this mystery? And people say that maybe all religious and spiritual practice is in some sense an effort to try and make sense of the fact that we're mortal. That's one way of looking at it. So I have over my desk a card printed out that says, don't think for a moment you're not going to die. And people think, well, this is morbid, but actually it's so helpful to me. And I come into the room and I see it and I say, yeah, I'm alive. I'm not dead yet. I'm going to be alive until I'm dead, but right now I'm alive. And the more I study death, this understanding kind of shines for me brighter and brighter that I am alive now, and this is something to celebrate and be grateful for. And we're all alive together right now in this moment. We're here alive. And at the same time, we're all dying together right now in this moment. The cells are kicking the bucket right and left in our bodies right now. And new ones are being born. And it's a kind of constant process. So dying is happening all the time too, in a way. It's not just a mark at the end of life, but things change, and one thing leaves or changes its form and takes another form. And so birth and death are kind of one thing, really. In Zen, there's a tradition in Japanese Zen for Zen monks to write a death poem. And every year at the new year, they would write a death poem, and a very short poem, and carry that poem with them all year. If they went on pilgrimage, they'd have the poem folded up with them in their pack, and they'd have a little bundle of money to pay for their funeral. And then if they died, they'd be ready with their death poem and their money. And then the next year, they would write a new death poem. And it's kind of a wonderful tradition. We did that in my Zen group, not my Zen group, but the Sangha that I belong to. We, when I was doing some teachings on death there, I had everybody write death poems. And it's kind of a great exercise. You might try it yourselves, and then share them with each other. Just, you know, what comes to you? Well, anyway, there's also a wonderful collection of Japanese death poems, which is quite interesting. And some of them are kind of humorous. And this is one that I like a lot. This is the death poem of Kozan Ichikyo. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My coming, my going, two simple happenings that got entangled. So it's just so kind of peaceful and calm and matter-of-fact in a way. And also, it emphasizes what I think is also an important thing, that we think about death. Where are we going to go? We wonder about death. Why don't we wonder just as much about birth? And, well, isn't that the same gate in a way? Where did we come from, and where are we going? It must be the same place, if it is a place, and maybe it's not a place. So, but just the idea that birth and death are kind of the same thing. It's just a different direction. But I'm sure that some of you have the experience. If you're with somebody when they die, or you're with somebody when they're born, you know, there may be different quality of joy or sorrow, but there's also the same kind of awe and grandeur to that event. And somehow it partakes of the same mystery. I was actually born, my birthday is the Day of the Dead, which is November 2nd. This is kind of living proof that birth and death can be one thing and happen on the same day. And when I turned 60, my sister went with me to Oaxaca, and we went to, in Oaxaca in Mexico, they have very large, all over Mexico, but particularly in Oaxaca, they have these huge celebrations of the Day of the Dead. So we went there for that week and had a wonderful time. And I figured, you know, if all of Mexico was celebrating my 60th birthday, I better go to the party. So it was really moving to me to see how they celebrate the Day of the Dead. And it happens more here now. There's an exhibit every year at the Oakland Museum of Day of the Dead altars, and some of you are probably familiar with these traditions. But in Oaxaca, we saw in the cemeteries, they're all decorated up, and families decorate the graves of their loved ones, and musicians come to the cemetery, and families stay up all night long around the gravestone of their loved ones. And the mariachi bands are moving through the cemetery playing music, and there's marigold flowers everywhere, and the scent of them everywhere. And the families are partaking of the favorite foods of the departed one and playing the songs that the departed one loved and drinking and partying. And some people told me that this is a very traditional time for families to get together, kind of like Thanksgiving here. And what I love is that the family is all together, but some of the people are dead and some of the people are alive, but they're all together. And it kind of thins the boundary between life and death and is a reminder to me that we're all, whether we're dead or whether we're alive, whether we've been born and died or we haven't been born yet or we're alive right now, somehow we're all here in this great universe, part of this life stream. And in some strange way that I can't understand, we're all together here, whether we're dead or alive. And yet it is this huge mystery. And what is it? How can a person be here and then not be here? And where, what does happen afterwards? And there's a little anecdote I like from another Zen master, Master Hakuin, who was a very famous Zen master in Japan. And a samurai asked him, "Master Hakuin, where will you go after you die?" And he said, "How am I supposed to know?" And the samurai said, "Well, you're a Zen master." And Hakuin said, "Yes, but not a dead one." We don't know. Let's let ourselves not know. There's a metaphor I like a lot that I find kind of helpful in thinking about death, which is that we're each like a wave in the ocean, and we take the form of a wave, and we move, and we crest, and we break. But so we seem to have a separate form, but of course we're not really separate. We're part of the whole stream of the ocean, the life stream of the ocean. We return when the wave breaks. It's still the same water, and then it's in the ocean, and some other wave forms. And that makes me feel kind of comforted in a way that we really are not separate. We're really all made of the same stuff, stardust or ocean or whatever. And we're just changing expressions of life, coming and going. But we're all kind of doing it together, so there's not an aloneness about it. Buddha's central teaching, one of his central teachings, was the teaching of impermanence, which is that everything does change and everything dies, and it seems like a very painful teaching, and it can be very painful, but it's also the teaching that things are born. I mean, thank goodness for impermanence, because just imagine for a moment how terrible it would be if we were not impermanent. If we were permanent and we were just here for everything and everything stayed the same as it was right this minute, and we just would, and flowers were all plastic flowers and nothing ever wilted and died and changed, this would be horrible. So thank goodness for impermanence. It's what makes everything precious and beautiful. And it also makes the opportunity for things to be born, because they're impermanent. It was not a permanent fact that this baby isn't here. I mean, then all of a sudden there is a new life. So, but anyway, Buddha's teaching of impermanence is, he put into what are called the five remembrances, which is a kind of Buddhist meditation that some people do regularly. And this is a translation by Thich Nhat Hanh, which I want to share with you. And for a while I was practicing these five remembrances every day, and It's a very strong kind of a practice. So it goes like this. "I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belongings. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand." So, this has quite a good effect, for me, a beneficial effect to keep repeating these things, because there's also some quality of trying to accept what is so painful and difficult, and not to fight against it. You know, we can add to our suffering by refusing to accept what it is. Well, I'm just looking down here, and I forgot to show you at the right moment something I brought to show you, so I'll show it to you now. And this is when I was in Oaxaca, I got one of these little scenes of skeletons. I know you're too far away to see it, but I'll put it up here, and you can look at it afterwards. And this is a scene which seems to me to sum up the whole thing. And it is a skeleton doctor and a skeleton nurse delivering a skeleton mother of a skeleton baby. So they're all, the baby's being born and the baby's already a skeleton, and life and death are all happening at once. And, you know, the moment we're born, we're already starting to die. And maybe the moment we die, we're starting to be born again in some other form. Who knows? So, I'll put that over here. And this I also brought, which is a statue of Buddha's Parinirvana. And this is a little wood carving from Thailand of Buddha. And whenever there's in the iconography of Buddhism, when Buddha is in this position, lying on his right side like this, looking very comfortable, this is his death. This is how he was when he died, supposedly. So. So anyway, I was coming to, I was talking about how accepting our own death and that we are mortal is, can be helpful, and it's one thing to do that. It's even harder to accept that the people we love will die, some of them, before we die. So we'll have to experience that, and that's a different kind of suffering. And so I've also been thinking about that, and it's kind of part of the same thing, but I wanted to share a story, a Buddhist story about the death of loved ones. And this is a sort of famous story, famous in Buddhist literature, of Kisa Gotami's mustard seed. And I'll just read you the story, and then I'll read you a little bit. This is, I'm reading from The Hidden Lamp, which is one of the books that Barbara mentioned that is a collection of stories of wise women through Buddhist history. And this story is from Buddha's time, India, 6th century. Kisa Gotami came from a poor family, but the son of a wealthy family loved her and married her. Her in-laws treated her unkindly because of her background, but when she gave birth to a son, they finally respected her. Then, when the child was a toddler, he died, and Kisa Gotami went mad with grief. She carried the dead child from house to house, begging for medicine to make him well, and everyone sent her away, saying, "The child is dead. No medicine can help him." At last, a kind man directed her to the Buddha. The Buddha said, "I will give you medicine to revive your child if you bring me a mustard seed from a house where no one has died." With renewed hope, Kisa Gotami went forth to get the mustard seed, but at every house she learned that someone had died. And so, still carrying her child's body in her arms, she returned to the Buddha. "Did you bring me a mustard seed?" he asked her. "I thought that death had happened only to my little son, but now I understand that it happens to everyone. Impermanence is the universal law." She buried her child in the forest and returned to the Buddha to receive ordination. And then I want to read from the commentary that was written by Christina Feldman, who's a Buddhist teacher from England. And she acknowledges what I also just want to say, that this is not a story about how everything was all of a sudden okay. It's a story about somehow accepting some deep truth about the suffering that she had, that she was not alone in this. So Christina Feldman says, Kisa Gotami's story is a story of every mother who loses a child, and every parent, I would add, who loses a child. The story of every human being who knows in their heart that to love, cherish, and care for another is to risk heartache and loss. The Buddha did not admonish Kisa Gotami for her grief and distress, nor did he lecture her on the inarguable laws of impermanence. Instead, he sent her into the village to find even one person who did not know the barren landscape of grief, the deep painfulness of being separated from those one holds most dear. Every home she went to, every person she spoke to, only revealed to her how vast is the landscape of loss. Each of us holds within us a personal story and a universal story. Our personal story, born of all that we have experienced and felt in this life, is unique to us. Our families, our joys and sorrows, our values, aspirations and hopes, our disappointments, the countless events of our lives have shaped who we are and how we see in ways that no single other human being can know. But when we understand that our personal story holds within it the universal story of all human beings, then we have the radical possibility of dissolving the boundaries of I and you and us and them. Kisa Gotami's realization that all mothers could experience just the same pain as she experienced did not necessarily diminish the grief, but she came to understand she was not alone. She began to accept that which had felt so deeply unacceptable. By acknowledging this, she embarked upon a path of seeking unshakable inner freedom. So, some radical acceptance is what Buddha is, or the teaching is calling for. And I have had in my life the experience of realizing that I've been with somebody I loved who was dying three times, and each time there have been kind of unexpected gifts in that as well. So I wanted to tell you about one such experience with a very, very close friend of mine. Perhaps my closest friend in Berkeley died about a year and a half ago. And I was one of five friends who were with her when she died. And she died of a stroke, an unexpected stroke. She was in the hospital already for some surgery in Oakland, and she had a massive stroke and she was unresponsive, and five of us went and stood around her bed as she died in the last hours of her life. And in fact, I was on her medical, I had medical power of attorney, I was on the list, and her doctor called me from the hospital in the morning. I was going to go in and visit her, thinking she was about to be discharged, and he said that she had had this massive stroke, and he asked my permission, because I was one of the contact people, not to intubate her, but to let her go. And I knew without any doubt, and she had been telling us all over and over again, I don't want to survive a massive stroke, I don't want to be without language or infirm or whatever. And her doctor said she would probably she would be in a terrible state if she lived. So anyway, I didn't have any doubt. And yet, just the taking that responsibility of saying, yes, let her go, don't intubate her, was a very powerful experience. And we can do that for each other. I mean, it was very profound for me, and I was also really grateful that it wasn't an ambiguous situation, that there wasn't any question of should I say yes or should I say no. Well, you know, I knew, and I was really grateful for that. But I was kind of surprised, even though I knew that there was no question in my mind what to say, that it was still hard to say it. So this is a big thing, you know. So anyway, there we were standing around her bed, and she was breathing, but she was completely unresponsive and didn't seem to know we were there, but we were singing to her and stroking her, and then at one point, she stopped breathing, and the nurse took her pulse and said, she's gone. And we all started weeping, and but we all just kept on singing and chanting. I led a Buddhist chant, and the feeling that I experienced was just of this incredibly palpable, it was as if the whole room just kind of filled up with love. I mean, it was already there. There was a lot of love. There was a momentum of love building as we were caring for her and attending to her and everything. She was a very loved person. But when she died, and there seemed to be this moment, oh, well, she's not here anymore in her spirit, then it was as if that spirit instead just turned into this room full of love with all these, you know, weird machines and tubes and everything were there. But it was as if everything in the room was kind of made out of love. There wasn't anything else that was real except love, whatever we mean by that. I knew what I meant by it in that moment, you know. And so when someone that you care for dies, there is this reminder of what is most important, and the impermanence of our lives makes it real that this is important. And also, you know, what to do, what you care about most, and for the sake of the person or who just died, kind of in honoring them, or, you know, she wouldn't want me to just fritter away my life in discouragement or something. So to keep on being alive for her sake, or to keep holding her in my heart. And so there's the gift of the awareness of love, and there's the gift of doing what you really care about doing. And there's just such a sense of connectedness, that to realize in some way that we're not separate, paradoxically, is more possible in that moment of transition. It's such a transitional moment. And I also want to acknowledge that this friend was 75 when she died. She'd had a very full life. She was spared living in some infirm state. It could have been a lot worse. It wasn't a super tragic death. It was a great loss to the people who loved her, and she had been looking forward to some more good years of her life. But I want to say that I haven't experienced in my immediate circle the death of somebody in that's really, really tragic, too young, too soon, a child, suicide. I mean, there's so many kinds of deaths, and I still believe that this idea that we're all connected and nobody's separate, and that to somehow accept the impermanence is what will help us. But I don't want to claim to have been able to. I haven't survived the kind of death that is just, you just can't, it's not okay for this person to have died. And I know there are such deaths as well. And how do you make that, how do you go on in your life with that too? And yet, whatever death it is, we're still all part of this life stream, I really feel. And the impermanence carries us all in our changing forms in some way. The interconnectedness holds us all. And in a way, I think there's something heroic about the fact that we all just go on living our lives and doing the best we can and taking care of ourselves, knowing that we're going to die. And we try to make a difference. We try to do the best we can. We try to love. And this is kind of wonderful that we all do this. And Norman Fisher, who's my Zen teacher and friend, says about death, he says, well, you know, we think we're worried about it. We're afraid of it. But we all know how to do it. Don't worry. We're all going to do it. We all know how to do it. We have within us the knowledge of how to do this, and we're going to do it. So don't worry about it. and really, there's some way in which our lives don't belong to us alone. You know, we need to, sometimes we forget that, and we we kind of squander our lives in different ways or do things that aren't good for us or whatever. But really, our lives belong to our friends and family and communities as well, and we owe it to the people who love us to take the best care of ourselves as we can. We don't own our lives as a separate thing. And in the same way, we don't really own our deaths. And each death makes a space that changes everything. And then for my friend's memorial service, which I helped to put together, I really came to realize how, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a village to bury an adult. And the fact that we can come together as human beings and share our grief and do this together is just a wonderful thing, that we can do this together. And every culture has ways of doing this, of acknowledging the passage of loved ones together in ritual or form or ceremony or whatever. So, again, we're not alone. We're not alone in our grieving either. So I wanted to end with another death poem and then have time for discussion. This is a poem by Myogen Steve Stuckey, who was an abbot of San Francisco Zen Center and a really wonderful teacher. And he died in December of 2013, just over 2 years ago, of pancreatic cancer, which is extremely painful. He was in a lot of physical pain. And he was at the same time still himself and still being present and loving somehow. And there's pain that's inevitable, but he did not seem to add to that pain fear or anger or despair. It was just the physical pain that it was. And this was his death poem, which he wrote fairly soon before he died. "This human body truly is the entire cosmos. Each breath of mine is equally one of yours, my darling. This tender abiding in my life is the fierce glowing fire of inner earth, linking with all phenomena, flashing to the distant horizon from right here now to just this. Now the horizon itself drops away, Bodhisvaha." So, those are some of my thoughts about how we can wake ourselves up to being alive as we contemplate death, and how it's an important part of our life that we do die. And I really welcome discussion and conversation. I also want to say I made some copies of, I'll leave them on the table here, of each one has Buddha's five remembrances that I read to you, and also has that death poem about empty-handed I entered the world. So they'll be over here.
So yes. If you have questions, raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone.
She's got the microphone.
Thank you for an interesting talk. The most interesting thing that I find about death, the death dying process, is that people don't seem to be bothered or worried about dying. I was around my mother for several years just prior to her death. She wasn't concerned. She wanted to die. Somehow I think people should be screaming and going, oh, my God, I'm dying. And they just accept it, which I find interesting. I'm wondering if you could make a few comments about, I am not worried about dying. I'm worried about becoming decrepit in my old age. Can you make a few comments that might calm my concern about that?
Well, I don't know that.
What would the Buddha say?
Well, we are of the nature to grow ill, too, yes. As in my mother, said, she used to say, the young are afraid of death, the old are afraid of dying, which is just what you were talking about, of the process. How difficult will it be? Or about the aging that's leading up to it. And I think that's part of what I was writing about in my book, This is Getting Old, and how to change our self-concept as we become more decrepit and lose abilities that we used to have, and to not be able to think of ourselves in the same way we used to. That is very difficult, and I think it's important to do that, to just say, okay, this is the time, part of my life, where I get to journey inward instead of up in the Sierras, or this is the part of my life where I get to go really, really slowly and notice each thing and just do one thing at a time. And I'm lucky if I can do that many things at a time, but I'll just try to do one. And somehow just keep on working with yourself and encouraging yourself that somehow you can accept this next state. I mean, I'm finding a lot of, I don't have any terribly painful challenges yet, physically painful, and that, I don't know how I will do with that when it comes. But I think, again, acceptance of what is always helpful of, okay, everything's really okay right now in this moment. Sometimes you can say that to yourself. And a lot of times it's thinking, hey, oh my God, what's going to happen next? When am I going to be, if I'm like this today, when am I going to be like next year or next month? Or, those kinds of fears and anxieties are added on, I think, to what's actually happening right now often. That's some thoughts about that.
It seems to me that one of the things that I'm back here.
Oh, there you are. Thank you.
One of the things that is important is to assess what level of risk you're willing to take during your life. Some people have such fears of dying that they will take virtually no risks. Other people seem to not care that they're going to die, or maybe they don't think they're going to die, so they take extreme risk. And depending where you are on that continuum, may reflect what you think about death and what you think about life, how you want to live your life, and there's anywhere in between. My own personal experience recently was that my wife died. We've been married for 40 years. She died about 2 months ago. Mm. And she was very risk averse, and she did not want me to take a lot of risks. And so I scaled back a lot of the things that I would do out of my love for her, because I didn't want her to feel the pain of, mm-hmm. oh my God, what if he slips and falls, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Then she died, and although I am not totally an extreme fanatic about taking no risk, I went up to visit my grandchildren, and I went cross-country skiing for the first time in 30 years that she would not have wanted me to do. And so her death kind of released me to take a different level of risk about how I feel, about how I want to live, and the risks that are involved in my own mortality.
So. Well, thank you. I think that's a wonderful story, actually. And you've been very loving to not take risks on your wife's behalf so that she wouldn't worry about you, and then to be able to take more risks after her death. I think it's also, I mean, risk is an interesting thing, because some people, I think, take risks in order to know that they're alive. I mean, there's that kind of adrenaline, you know, people who do really adventure sports and things like that. I think and I used to, years ago, I used to do a little rock climbing, and I wasn't doing it super dangerously, but it seems really scary climbing up these surfaces with a rope. But what I loved was I just had to be there every second of the time. I really knew I was alive. But I think there's different parts of it. We owe it to the people who care about us not to take foolish risks with our lives. And on the other hand, we owe it to ourselves to live a full life. And it's risky to get out of bed in the morning. I mean, really, it's all one big risk. So you can't avoid. I mean, your wife died before you did, and she was the one not taking risks. It doesn't mean you're going to live longer if you don't take risks, because it's already a risk. And in fact, I was really interested. I think it's in this wonderful book of Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, which I really recommend. He speaks about senior housing facilities now, or communities for elderly people, which are realizing that even people who are somewhat disabled or have Alzheimer's or something, to let them take some risks, and that people, you know, that the tradition has been, oh no, they can't go out there because they might trip and fall, and we promise in this nursing home we're not going to let any risk happen to your loved one, and they won't be able to smell a flower because they might be allergic to it and they might sneeze and stuff like that. So the more people are able to actually make some decisions for themselves, the happier they are and the longer they live. So there's some amount of risk that is part of being a human being, and I think it's just an ongoing exploration for each of us. How much is the appropriate amount to take? And I think it's wonderful that you brought that up. Give them a turn in the front row afterwards too. Okay. Yes.
Yes. A human life is the most precious gift that we can have, in terms of Buddhism. And in terms of the continuum of birth and death, we have an assisted birth. What is the Buddhist teaching on assisted suicide?
I don't think there is a Buddhist teaching on assisted suicide. And, you know, in Buddhist time, there was no such phrase as assisted suicide. I think there was a sense that one of the precepts is not to take life, and I'm assuming that taking one's own life probably fell under that umbrella. However, all of the precepts are practiced with the idea that you can't keep them. You know, you vow not to take life every whenever I do a ceremony, and all our ceremonies were constantly vowing to do impossible things, and vowing not to kill. Well, it doesn't just mean don't murder people. It means, you know, you're killing when you eat meat, when you step on a bug, when you put pesticide in the garden. It's constantly happening. So I think there are times when breaking a precept in what looks like you're breaking the precept, you're actually keeping the precept. You're somehow nurturing life, because the positive side of it is nurturing life. And if a person's life is not able to be nurtured, and if nurturing life means nurturing the life of the other people around them and their own life having a shorter time that's richer or whatever, I think that falls within Buddhist precepts, in my opinion.
If we're reincarnated, do we actually die?
Well, I don't know if we are reincarnated, and I don't think we do actually die. As I was saying, I think there's some, you know, life stream, Buddha nature, soul, you could call it different things, but something that continues and doesn't die. And in the absolute sense that there is no birth and no death, our life is beginningless and endless. But there definitely is the death of a person who has a certain body and has a name and an identity and whose obituary you read in the newspaper. You can mark that. But whether they have an afterlife or not, that identity dies and is not... Susan Moon isn't going to turn up again under a bush or something after I die. But... So she'll die, but I don't think something in me will die.
I'd like to share a poem I wrote. Wearing mother's clothes. Does it matter that the voices of the dead sing in these clothes, or that even a woman who lived for 28 years in one house changed every day without knowing it? The things are patient. They wait and wait for us to organize our lives around them. Each unworn sweater in the bottom drawer represents a life we have chosen not to live or were too busy to imagine. What kind of courage does it take to walk in the clothes of the dead, to raise your arms to the daring sun whose life will never again touch that body, the one whose place you have taken?
Thank you. That's very, very beautiful.
Beautiful. Thank you, Helena.
Really moving. Thank you.
Questions?
I really connected with your story about being the power of attorney for someone who's dying. In my case, it's a friend who's now 88, and she has dementia and is in nursing place and just wants to die. And I totally understand that. I feel like, and she's kind of relieved to hear, I mean, because she's always talking about wanting to die, and I don't argue with her. I don't try to argue her out of it at all. But it also occurs to me how somehow the way life flows, it's like it's such a tragedy if someone dies who's, say, 30. And there's also that difficulty of accepting it. But there is something about as we grow older, I think we naturally kind of let go. And maybe not totally, but there is something about the whole life process that helps us, I think, toward accepting that it's not endless. Thank goodness.
Yes, thank you for that comment. That goes with what the first questioner said, the first man you spoke over there, about how people you know seem to not be so afraid of dying. And I think there is a natural movement in that direction as we get old and get more uncomfortable and feel like we've maybe done what we wanted to do, or maybe we didn't do it, but we're not going to do it now. And also, another thing is that our friends die. I mean, my grandmother had a best friend all her life from the time they were 7, and they both died in their, well, my grandmother was in her 80s, and this friend survived her by about 10 years. And but they, all their lives, they saw each other constantly. And I visited Aunt Dorothy. She was an adopted aunt. She wasn't my blood aunt. But after some years after my grandmother's death, and she was kind of, she had her wits about her totally, but she was very frail, and she was kind of sitting up in bed, and she said, you know, every day I miss your grandmother. I miss your grandmother every day. And all of my friends have died, and I don't have anybody I'm close to except my sons and their children. She didn't have anybody of her own in her peer group. They're all gone. And it was a very lonely feeling. Of course, we want to make friends with younger people as we get old, and we do that, and that's wonderful. But that must also help to get ready to die. You know, it makes me think of the words of Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. If you get there before I do, tell all my friends I'm coming too. You know, the idea that, well, my friends have all done it, I guess I'll do it, whatever it is, I'll do it too.
Following up on what you just said, there's a quest, a part of death is a quest for immortality that we have throughout our lives. And in many, many ways, it shapes our lives, such as through our children having immortality. Or if you look at it culturally, in terms of the Egyptian pyramids, here's an example of immortality that involves the whole country, the whole fortune, a whole empire to build these pyramids and prepare them for the life after death. It's present in things like adventuring, where you risk your life a bit and survive and have a sense of a bit of immortality. It's there in what you produce. You want to leave things behind you so that others will remember you. The only thing that really is immortal is part of your RNA, which keeps going on. And really, the purpose of life is we're just a vehicle of our RNA carrying on, which it does a very good job of.
Thank you. That's a really helpful observation and reminder, too, that all this rush to do things to be remembered. After we die, we're not going to know whether people are remembering us or not anyway.
Okay, this is the last question.
Okay. Sorry, you can talk to me after.
Thank you for speaking today. So I'm wondering how to bridge the, perhaps it's a paradox, of accepting what is, not having attachment with the desire to minimize suffering, change the world, etc.
Well, I think you've asked the sort of quintessential Buddhist question, which I ask constantly of myself, and it's a great question. And accepting what is does not mean resigning ourselves to what is, and it does not mean thinking that everything's just okay and fine the way it is. It means we start where we are and do what we can to bring compassion forth and to alleviate suffering. And in this way, we also become more connected to other people and feel our interconnectedness and feel, in a sense, it's we can accept our own impermanence perhaps more easily if we are joining with other people to really try to alleviate suffering and then justice in the world. And there's so much for us to do, of course, right now, and has always been, I suppose, but you know, with the environment and the refugees and the wars and everything, we need to do what we can, I believe, and to be a full human being while you're alive, to find some way. And everybody has a different way. It doesn't mean everybody has to, become a climate scientist or something. But we all can contribute to, with compassion, to alleviating suffering, and that's very important too. I don't think it's a contradiction. In some way, it has to not be a contradiction. If we can accept ourselves as we are right now, and then we can go forth from that.
Thank you so much, Susan. And we do have some of Susan's books for sale over here. Not very many, but...
Thank you very much for being here. It was a pleasure.